Welcome to JS on Politics. We've got a very busy day on the political front here in Wisconsin, and we'll get right into that. Here's a look at what's happening today on our show. Now, voters went to the polls Tuesday and delivered some more competitive than expected April elections. We'll take a look at what's ahead. We'll also get an update on a busy day in Madison as the Assembly tries to finish its work for the session. Craig Gilbert is in South Carolina and will give us the latest in the presidential demolition derby. And our panel will kick around some of the national issues that have local ties. And, of course, there'll be time for some viewer questions, so please send those in. Well, let's start by introducing our panel this morning. I'm your host, Greg Borowski. We have Dan Bice, Watchdog columnist, Mary Spicuzza, political reporter, and from Madison, Patrick Marley, one of our Madison Bureau reporters. And we'll get started with Patrick on the state Supreme Court race. So we're going to show a slide here that has the results from Tuesday. Justice Rebecca Bradley, the incumbent, came in first with 45% of the vote. Joanne Kloppenburg, who's run for this seat before, came in with 43%. So it looks to be a pretty competitive race in April, particularly because the incumbent didn't get above 50%. Patrick, talk with us a little bit about what that means, or what do you see ahead in the next weeks here as this race approaches?
Yeah, the day after the election, I talked to people on both sides, and I think everybody could agree they were a little surprised that Kloppenburg performed better than they'd expected and Bradley performed a little worse than they expected. It shows that it's sort of game on for the April 5 election. It's very close. Bradley's obviously got the advantage. Everybody's looking at what the presidential turnout's going to be because Wisconsin's primary for president is the same day. The turnout's going to maybe double, but I think the advantage for Kloppenburg in having come within 2 points of Bradley is that she's going to be able to attract donors by showing that she can keep the race close, and it increases the possibility that a third-party group comes in to run ads helping her. We've seen that in the past for Bradley, but not for Kloppenburg so far. Okay.
Well, let's talk to the panel. What's your take on this one, Dan, and especially the outside money and what this will mean to...
Well, not just that. I mean, there was a third candidate in this race, as Judge Donald, who ends up getting about 12%, and you could expect most of those voters to go to Kloppenburg. In addition, the Bradley side severely outspent the other two candidates, so you have that factor as well. Plus, there was a strong push for Bradley in talk radio here. I heard her on Charlie Sykes' show, on Mark Belling's show. She was given lots of free time, so she had all of the advantages, yet she comes up with only 45% of the vote.
I thought you were going to say the other candidate was Governor Walker, because she's so closely tied to him that in a way it seems like a referendum on him. And so I think that is a bad sign, especially because it's not like turnout in Waukesha was bad. They ran out of ballots countywide, Brookfield, Menominee Falls. A lot of people turned out, and presumably those were
not that you see the governor in any of the ads for Bradley. She's kept her distance, but you can expect the other side to try to tie those two closely together, because he's appointed her as circuit judge, appeals court judge, Supreme Court judge. Her rapid rise is basically a Walker creation.
Yeah, well, let me ask, Patrick, because we've seen in these Supreme Court races before that the key isn't the spending by the candidates as much as these other groups that'll come in and pour a lot more money in the race that can be a lot more negative and pointed in their ads. Is there a group that's going to come to Bradley's side? I guess we can see where Kloppenburg will get support, but is there someone there ready to jump in?
Oh, we've already seen money on the Bradley side. $900,000 to $1 million was spent by a group called the Wisconsin Alliance for Reform. We don't know much about that group, but it's following the same playbook that has been played in past Supreme Court races by conservative groups. Early ads, positive for the candidate, the support. Later ads, which we haven't seen yet from anybody, attacking the opponent. The Greater Wisconsin Committee is the liberal group that has played in a lot of these races in the past, but sometimes stayed out. I think expecting them to show up would there's a very high chance of that now that the race is so even.
Essentially, we don't know much about them, but it's a Republican front group, and it'll be a Democratic front group that gets involved. Even though the candidates are running as nonpartisan, the stakes are such that the Republicans want Bradley to win, Democrats want Kloppenburg to win, and we see the significance of that in just the past week where there was a 4-3 vote. It's the first time Bradley's gotten involved and made a decision. Without her, it would have been 3-3.
Did she listen to that case, though?
She did not listen to that case. She got involved in it anyway, but if she hadn't voted, it was a warrantless search case, a Fourth Amendment case, and she voted with the conservatives. David Prosser, who's generally conservative, switched over and voted with the liberals.
All right, let's turn to the county executive race and show those results. Where, as we've been talking in past weeks, it was a Chris versus Chris race. In this case, the challenger came out slightly on top, Chris Larson ahead of incumbent Chris Abele. Dan, Abele's already spent a lot of money. How much is he going to spend, or can he spend in a case?
How much can he spend? That, I mean, that's a good question. Yeah. I mean, this was the stunner of the night that no one expected, I would say outside of Abele's pollster, this result. He's spent more than $1 million on the primary. People inside the campaign, when I said, can I estimate that he'll spend at least $5 million, they told me $5 million was low, that he'll spend whatever it takes, $7-8 million possibly. And, you know, we now know why he started going on the air in October. No one could figure it out. They thought, well, he's relatively safe. He's run against Chris Larson, who's underfunded, has a lot of staff turmoil, and yet Larson comes out in front.
Right. So if you're Chris Larson, asking me this from Mary, I mean, you're kind of hoping for highly competitive Hillary Clinton race, right, on the Republican side to settle in, because you got to get more. Doesn't have the same money to compete with
he
Chris
doesn't
Abele.
Have the same money. I mean, I think he benefited from there was low turnout, but I think a lot of Larson supporters were highly motivated. Sorry, like teachers, bus drivers, and so I think that he benefited from that. But yeah, I think he wants the Dem base coming out.
I think there was also another factor involved, and that is this Wisconsin Working Families Party, Marina Dmitrievich, ended up doing a number of attack ads, mailers in the last few days, tying Chris Abele to everything from Governor Walker to the murder raid in Milwaukee. And there was no negative ads directed back at Larson. And I'm told that the Abele people have hundreds and hundreds of pages of material that they hope to unload on Larson. So that'll be what to look for. All that millions of dollars is going to be spent attacking
him. Let's talk now about the Milwaukee mayor's race. Another case where none of the incumbents, you know, got over 50% of the vote, which is often kind of a magic, even if it's just a psychological number at this point. But Tom Barrett came in at 46%. Bob Donovan, who will be facing, had 33%. And then Alderman Joe Davis, who dropped out and endorsed Donovan, had a smaller number. Does that endorsement?
Well, he lost.
I mean, does that Davis endorsement help Donovan? Are his voters a natural Donovan constituency, do you think?
That's an interesting question. I think a lot of Davis supporters are not going to back Donovan. Davis has talked about the mass incarceration of African American males. He's talked about more discrepancy in Milwaukee of African Americans tending to be poorer in less developed neighborhoods. That is not Donovan's bread and butter for his campaign. He is the law and order guy. He is more cops. So he's since said at that announcement, he said that he is willing to sit down and talk with people, which is the first time I've heard him say that, because he's typically wants chases and more beat cops and. I don't see the Davis constituents being natural Donovan supporters.
But you did see Donovan going on Black Radio yesterday, something I've never heard or seen him do before. So it's something he realizes he has to do. He finished with 33% of the vote. That's a 13 percentage point gap. There was a poll that came out just late last week that showed among African Americans that Barrett gets almost half of the vote, much more, twice what Davis gets, and Donovan's under 10%. So he would have to do major work to get out there. The only thing that would be interesting is if Sheriff Clark would get involved somehow and take a side in this thing, because his politics not much different than Donovan, and his message and has resonated in the Black community.
All right, let me ask you just really quickly before we move on, Dan. So of the three, who do you think is the incumbent in the safest position for April?
I would say the mayor. The mayor, because one thing we didn't discuss is the Democratic presidential contest. I think the Sanders people and the Clinton people who come out will be supportive of him. I don't think anyone's ever asked Donovan who he's supporting, but I'm guessing it's not Bernie Sanders.
Probably not. All right, let's turn now and let's go back, bring Patrick in again, because we want to talk about what's happening in Madison today. And just the first thing, aside from the legislative session going on, there's a very large protest going on today, the Day Without Latinos protest. Patrick, can you tell us about that? I know it's kind of an annual thing, but what's the motivating you know, issue this year that's got so many people there?
Yeah, this, I mean, if this is the first time I've seen anything like this since Act 10, the huge protest we saw in 2011. Thousands of people on the Capitol Square, in the Capitol, while the assembly's in session, protesting, chanting, showing American flags, Mexican flags, and big banners that say Wisconsin is not Arizona. What they're protesting are two bills, one that is before Governor Walker, that would limit the ability of local governments to issue photo IDs. The other, which is passed the assembly but not gotten any further, would put fines on so-called sanctuary cities, the cities that adopt policies that say police can't ask about the immigration status of those charged with crimes. The Latinos who are here in force are trying to stop these things, get Walker to veto the one, get the other bill to stall right there. In fact, one conservative Latino leader is asking the assembly to take it up again, the sanctuary cities bill, and to reconsider it and vote it down. The Latinos I was talking to today say they see this as very damaging to their community, and it frustrates them a great deal against Republicans, particularly with Trump in the race and all the
referenced earlier, the Act 10 protest things that didn't, in the end, make a difference in terms of swaying the opinions of the lawmakers and Scott Walker. Does something like this have an effect, do you think, Dan or Mary? What do you think?
I think one thing that lawmakers are going to need to think about are the elections coming up. This is a presidential year, so higher Dem turnout. Do they want to alienate a huge chunk of Latino voters as they head off? Because this is like the last week that the assembly's in session. So I do think that there are increasing numbers of Latino voters who will turn out against candidates who they see as being anti-Latino.
There is a push to try to, on the Republican side, to get more and more Hispanics to vote for them, particularly using the issue of school choice. But, I think it could have an impact. I mean, it does have an impact when you have tens of thousands of people come in and try to voice their opinion on these things.
All right. Patrick, let me ask you, because I know you'll be covering the legislature into the evening today, but give us just the top, you know, two or three items that'll be sort of the headline things that they're voting on today that, you know, viewers would want to be paying attention to.
Yeah, this is the last day that the State Assembly is to be in session for the year. So they're going to go until midnight. They started at 11 a.m. They're going to take up bills limiting or easing regulations on wetlands, easing regulations on there's another environmental one out there. They're also taking up a bill that would bar county executives from serving in the legislature. That's aimed at stopping the candidacy or hurting the candidacy of Mark Harris. He's the Winnebago County executive who's running for state senate. So there's a lot on the agenda. There are dozens and dozens of bills.
All right, let's talk a little bit, you know, with the panel here on. So this is, you know, kind of a measuring stick in the fall. We talked about how is Scott Walker going to do in the legislative session? How engaged is he going to get? Does he have a big victory here? He's signing the Planned Parenthood measure this morning. But what would be Walker's biggest takeaway, do you think, Dan?
His biggest takeaway?
Yeah,
I mean, he's considered right now one of the most unpopular governors in the nation. I don't think there's anything major out there out of this stuff that's going to move him off. He's been stuck at 37-38% favorability rating. I don't think there's anything substantial, even though there's this mad rush, a number of bills, and I credit Patrick for being able to name all of these different bills and what's contained in them, but there's nothing that's overwhelming. The Planned Parenthood bill will play to his base. It's not going to reach across. If he's going to make progress and get back on track, get himself back over 50%, he's got to reach out to independents. And most of these bills are Republican bills, such as the Mark Harris bill that he mentioned. These are bills that appeal to their base. They don't get beyond that.
Well, we have a segment coming up where we're going to throw out random numbers to Patrick and see if we can identify what bill they're associated with.
You give me bill numbers, I'm going to do.
Could you tell us about AB 251?
Well, that's actually an interesting bill, though, because...
Rules, but, AB 251
is an interesting bill because Governor Walker's been pushing for that one, Americans for Prosperity, WMC, and it's basically this very kind of obscure rewriting the rules bill that a lot of people, it's incredibly long and confusing.
The public doesn't care about it. But there are special interests that do.
Right. Donors care. And I think that...
And talk radio cares.
Talk radio cares. Vicki McKenna and Charlie Sykes.
And the courts may care because the Legislative Council, that's the group of nonpartisan lawyers for the legislature. They say that it is arguably unconstitutional. So when they say that, they used very hedged language. That's sort of a signal that that thing could face real difficulties in the court.
I feel like I'm at kind of a legislative, you know, reporting nerd convention here. I'm making the next time I go to Las Vegas, I'm bringing Mary to help me count cards. So we're going to leave it there now for Madison and go and shift to the presidential campaign in South Carolina and go to this taped segment with our Washington Bureau Chief. All right, we're joined now by Craig Gilbert, our Washington Bureau Chief, who this week is in South Carolina following the candidates. Craig, I wanted to ask you first about Jeb Bush. You were at a rally for him yesterday where it didn't sound like his supporters were feeling all that confident going into Saturday's vote. What was your sense of that rally and where Jeb Bush is standing?
Yeah, there were a couple of interesting things about that event. One was that he was kind of wearing his disappointment very openly. I mean, at one point he talked sarcastically about, you know, I guess I just have to stop campaigning. It's all over. Everybody's declared it over, which was kind of an odd note to strike in a campaign. And then a succession of supporters and sympathetic members of the audience took turns kind of giving him advice and commiserating with him about the effects of Trump on the campaign, but also questioning how he's handled Trump and how he's handled all of these things and Trump's attacks. Some people were basically saying you need to get tougher and you need to be more of an SOB, and other people were saying, hey, Trump's kind of thrown you off your game. Don't pay attention to him. Don't fight back. Don't get dragged down into his game. And it was just a very kind of poignant and moment, an event that was kind of really emblematic in a lot of ways of the problems and his struggles in this campaign, which seemed to go on and on.
Yeah, well, let's talk about Donald Trump, because you're at a Trump rally this morning. And after the debate last weekend, there was some sense that Trump may have overplayed things by attacking George W. Bush and some of the statements he made. Do you get any sense that Trump's, you know, paying any price for that, or how's he faring there?
It's not clear yet whether he is. I mean, it's not clear yet what that, you know, what that tipping point is for him, he's defying Republican orthodoxy in so many ways and pressing so many hot buttons, but we've yet to see a case where he just kind of went over the line in the eyes of his own supporters. I mean, he clearly does seem to have a ceiling of support, but he's got a stranglehold on a third of the Republican primary electorate. And even talking to people here who may not agree with him totally about the Iraq War, I mean, everybody thinks that mistakes were made and that it didn't work out all that great in the end. And if you like him because he's outspoken and because you think he's the guy that's going to shake things up, that one comment is not going to bother you.
All right. Now, another candidate there, we had an endorsement yesterday by Governor Nikki Haley of Senator Marco Rubio. And even Jeb Bush had said that Haley's endorsement could be a game changer kind of thing. How important is that for Rubio down there?
Well, it could be important. I mean, the history of these things is really mixed. I mean, her endorsement 4 years ago for Mitt Romney against Newt Gingrich didn't really seem to help Mitt Romney very much. But because Rubio's in a tight struggle for second place with a bunch of other candidates like he was in New Hampshire, it could be the kind of thing that could move some voters. And it only takes a few points, to change the psychology and kind of the momentum effects of these races. And if Rubio can beat out, you know, Kasich and or even Cruz and certainly Bush for second place, I mean, he would be on his way to starting to consolidate some of that mainstream Republican support against Trump.
All right, let's talk briefly about Ted Cruz, who he has a win in Iowa and a second place finish in New Hampshire. What is he hoping for or expected to do in South Carolina?
Well, this is supposed to be a good state for him. He'd really like to close the gap with Donald Trump, you know, going into this string of other southern states that advantage him and help him. So he does have to do well. I think, you know, anything below second would be a real blow to his candidacy because there's, you know, he appeals to socially conservative voters. There's a lot of them here. It's been kind of a wild campaign for him, too. He had this sort of marathon press conference yesterday where he was ripping into both Trump and Rubio for things they'd said about him in the campaign, defending what he said about them. So it's been kind of a melodrama, but I think he has to finish second or better, and he'd like to close the gap as much as possible. with Trump to get some momentum going into the big Super Tuesday states.
All right, and lastly, let me ask about the Democratic side. It's a little unusual that they have the Republican vote this Saturday and the Democratic vote a week later, but what's the early line on Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders down there?
Just that she's very much the favorite here because of the demographics of the state. I mean, all the polling suggests she has a big advantage among African-American voters. It's more than half the electorate here. Anything short of a clear victory would be, you know, really damaging to her, especially if she doesn't, if she performs below expectations in Nevada.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Craig. We'll be following your work, and our viewers can as well. You can follow his stories at jsonline.com as he covers the campaign in South Carolina. Thanks, Craig.
Talk to you then.
All right. Thanks. All right, we're back live, and we're going to continue our discussion of national politics and how some of them have some good local connections this week. And we're joined now by Christian Schneider, one of our editorial page columnists from Madison. And we thought, Christian, because your name is Christian, you'd be the first question on this Pope versus Donald Trump, you know, Christian questioning back and forth. Tell us what's going on with that and what's your take on it.
Yeah, so evidently the Pope fired back at Donald Trump for his stance on illegal immigrants and building a wall and all this kind of stuff. And, in the end, basically, this is just going to give Donald Trump, he's going to dominate the news cycle on the way to the South Carolina elections. But I believe Trump just called the Pope a disgrace for his comments.
Yeah. Well, which doesn't hurt him very much in South Carolina, but he said that for a religious leader to question someone's faith is disgraceful, and that he's not the one who's been undermining Christianity. It's instead the current president.
Right. So it's some of this. The backstory goes: the Pope has been in Mexico and had a mass near the border, and is talking about the wall that Trump is proposing. So that gets us all going. But let's talk. Is it ever a good strategy to attack or a major religious leader in the middle of a presidential primary? I mean, anybody seen that before?
No, I mean, there's a little bit of karma going on since, obviously, Trump has been the one attacking Obama for his faith, and whether he's a Christian or whether he's Muslim or whatever, and to have it come back at him is, sort of funny.
So I'm going to wait to see if there's a Twitter war between the two of them.
I saw there already tweets all over the place on this thing.
Yeah, well, let's talk about another person who got into Donald Trump's sights this week. You know, you seem everyone gets pulled in eventually. This was Paul Ryan.
Do we get pulled in eventually?
Well, I'm hoping so. Yeah. I mean, it's just for the status.
Well, no, we've made
but,
it then.
You know, so Donald Trump went after Paul Ryan, so, you know, he was suggesting he was a major reason the campaign failed 4 years ago with Mitt Romney, and that the work from Ryan on entitlements was a big problem.
Wasn't it that as soon as Ryan was picked as the vice president that he knew Romney wasn't going to win and it was all over for the campaign?
Yeah. But
obviously this is pushback because Ryan, without saying it, has tried to establish himself as the anti-Trump to define what is conservatism. And I don't think Trump likes that. He wants to be who he is. You know, and his campaign has been about style over substance, over style over particular, you know, conservative themes. It's a contrast between those two. And you know, I'm just a little surprised it took him this long to go after Paul Ryan.
Yeah, in addition to the fact that it's just complete nonsense. I mean, when it was August 12th, 2012, I think, that Romney picked Ryan, and Romney was down in the polls by about like 48, 43, something like that, and then it ended up being almost being a tie. And that was, you know, that was even before Romney did the whole, you know, 47% comment, which Ryan was really the guy that had to kind of walk that back. So
you're going to start fact-checking Trump? Is that... it's a very it's probably full time employment, but
that was going to be one of my points was that that's like the least offensive thing that he says in any given speech, and yet, you know, we're talking about that just because of the Paul Ryan angle. But I don't know who he's trying to appeal to with that, because the people that attack Paul Ryan are typically those really far on the right who think he's like a deal maker and all that kind of stuff. But Trump's not over there. He's just he just attacks everyone regardless. And so
I think it's funny because many of the criticisms of Trump have to do with what he's saying and the content. But I think his supporters like him primarily because of his style, the way he says things, the fact
says
that he doesn't care. Yeah, right. It makes him appear authentic in the way Bernie Sanders does. So I don't think, you know, you point out, okay, this isn't actually true. To supporters, I don't think it really matters. I think it just shows that he's willing to go up against the Pope. He's willing to go against a party leader. This shows that he's a strong character. I think it helps him in many of the places he is.
Christian, let me ask you this question on that theme as you were kind of alluding to. I mean, Trump has his supporters. He's got clearly a ceiling, but also apparently a floor with them. Are these really, you know, true Republicans or more independents who are just gravitating toward Trump? Because if you insult every Republican leader at some point, you would think you would offend every Republican voter at some point, right?
Yeah, I think that is the case. I mean, it's funny because, you know, working in Republican politics in the mid-2000s, you know, the party was hemorrhaging people and losing every election, and we were sitting around trying to figure out, you know, how do we get more people in the party? How do we make this a bigger tent? And then now we see who's in the tent, and we're like, okay, where's the bouncer? We need to get some of these people out of here. Because, yeah, I mean, these Trump people aren't typically that conservative or conservative at all. And like Dan said, I mean, they're just there based on style, based on a guy who's going to say what he thinks and isn't, you know, intimidated by the political correctness people.
But you make it sound like that's somebody else's fault. I mean, since Rush Limbaugh emerged in the late 80s, style has been very important. This bombastic style has appealed to a lot of conservatives.
And Rush Limbaugh really played a big role in promoting Trump. I mean, he was derelict in his duty to weed him out. He praised Trump, and, you know, all these other national conservative radio talk show hosts really talked him up, and now, you know, they're paying the price for it.
Yeah, we haven't talked about yet one of the other big news items from Washington was the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and the opening that presents. And I'm just interested for our viewers, you know, where does that put, you know, Ron Johnson in terms of, does he have to line up with the view that they shouldn't confirm anybody?
Is
he going to get more pressure in the fall to vote or at least allow a hearing? What do you think?
No, I think he's pretty comfortable where he is to say that President Obama should not make an appointment, and if he does, that the Republicans in the Senate should resist that. And what they're latching onto is the fact that President Obama, when he was in the Senate, that he helped encourage filibusters to stop the appointments of Roberts and
Alito.
Right. So I think they're going to use this hypocrisy argument to justify their position opposing an appointment. But there will be some pressure. I think. The people on Obama's side are going to say he should go ahead and appoint it. The question is, will people in the middle believe that they should go ahead and make an appointment? And I think it'll depend on something that we don't know, and that's how many 4-4 decisions will emerge between now and later this year.
All right, let's turn now in our final few minutes here to some of our viewer questions. And I'm going to throw the first one to Christian, and this is from Mike in Madison, who it's more of a statement than a question, but I want you to respond to it. It says, if the Bradley race is a referendum on Walker, good luck to Justice Kloppenburg. How do you see that race coming out, Christian?
Well, I mean, we've kind of been here before. The Kloppenburg Prosser race in 2011 was a referendum on Scott Walker, and Prosser very narrowly came out, and things aren't nearly as high strung as they were at the time. So I think Bradley's already being on the bench helps her a little bit. She's going to spend a lot of money. Kloppenburg is not a good candidate. I've pointed out in my column some of the competing positions that she's taken. I think the vote the other night shows that it could be very close. A lot of the vote came from Milwaukee and Madison, because especially in Milwaukee where you had those big county exec and mayor races. So I think the vote isn't – it's going to be a different pie that's divided up, a different electorate. It looks like it's going to be pretty close.
A couple of things to point out. It is true Kloppenburg did not run a good race last time. She did not spend much time in Milwaukee, and she underperformed in Milwaukee. So there'll be more votes there. Secondly, will she be a better candidate? And then three, Walker is not the same person he was when she ran against Prosser. He at that time his approval ratings are around 10 points higher. So those are factors that are different from last time.
I don't think his approval rating was 10 points higher in the heat of Act 10. I think it was still pretty low.
in the heat of Act 10, maybe, but I think he did take some hits in the presidential campaign, and I think that a lot of moderate Republicans have the luster is kind of off of
we'll
Walker.
We'll get PolitiFact to check out this.
Let's get to our next question. This is, I'll throw to Mary first. This is from Just Askin, who says, how can Hillary ever really pull ahead in the delegate count? The Democrats' system means it will be a close call all the way. So they don't give any winner-take-all thing. So if Bernie stays close, it's going to stay close, right?
I think it'll be close, but I think a lot of people are expecting it to stay close. So I don't know that Hillary has, I think for a while, it's been looking like it's going to be a long, drawn-out battle.
Does she end up relying, Dan, do you think, on all the superdelegates? Or if, I mean, is
she's
that
relying
a
on
margin
that.
Plus, there for her?
You know, I think the Democratic Party made a mistake by burying these debates early on, and he was able to, Bernie Sanders was able to build momentum behind the scenes, and with the Iowa win, she went from being a very confident, careful front runner to being in a huge fight.
All right, that's where we're going to leave it for today's show. We'll be back next week at the same time and same place, so please join us then for the latest on Wisconsin politics.